Hey, everybody. This is Tom Sharpling. It's exciting to be here with you. And boy, we have something exciting right now. It's the first edition of the Best Show Book Club. Can you believe it? Finally, after all the talk, it has begun. And we're starting this with a great book. Couldn't kick it off with something as fun as can be. A book called Nothing But a Good Time. The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. And the book is by Tom Beaujour and Richard Beanstock. And we have them both here. So thank you, Tom and Richard, for joining us today for our first book club.
Thank you for having us.
We are one person.
Yes, it happens.
It does. The singularity is underway. And we are also joined by Joe Dana, a Best Show listener who is a metal enthusiast who can represent the listeners on this one.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thanks for being here, Joe. And of course, we have AP Mike, Pat Byrne, and Jason Gore here also. And it's a nice group.
Hi, guys. Group.
Hey, everybody.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
So, Tom and Richard, I guess let's begin at the beginning. Where did the idea come from to tell this story and to tell it as an oral history? And what is your relationship to the music that comprises the book?
The decision to do an oral history, I'll do this backwards, was we were on the fence and our agent said, "You're going to do an oral history, right?" And we're like, "Okay, that's decided." I am of the exact age that I was 15 in 1986. I'm 50. So this stuff was just coming directly at me when I was at that age. And I'm a guitar player too. So I was consuming this music with no level of irony or distance or anything. It was just like, these guys are the coolest guys. And it was weird because I was also, I like had a mixtape that had Husker Du Flip Your Wig on one side and Poison Open Up and Say Ah on the other. So I was sort of had my feet in both worlds, but this music, I think because it was so visual and the Guitar Heroes and stuff, was really sort of what captured my imagination and was like this aspirational thing. I was like, I would like to just be as cool as CC DeVille one day. So it really was the music that sort of shaped a lot of how I look at the world, unfortunately. And Rich, you know, is a little bit younger, but I think was equally sort of tainted by it. What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar experience to Tom, except I am much, much more youthful, you know, in spirit. I'm 5 years younger than him. So I grew up with the stuff as well. Was totally consumed by it. Like Tom, I play guitar. So as a guitar player, again, like this was the stuff, you know, like what would you want other than to be George Lynch or Warren DeMartini or, you know, CC DeVille or any of these guys. So I was completely enthralled by it from that angle. And then just everything about the music, I mean, there was no, you know, irony or distance. I just was completely sucked in. And to me, seeing, you know, Motley Crue, the Looks That Kill video or something like that, it was like these guys were like superhuman. They were like, you know, not of this earth to my 8-year-old brain. And I was just totally in from the second I saw and heard it.
Yeah, I mean, there is kind of a funny thing when you think about that, the metal, the rise of metal kind of aligned with the rise of that wave of wrestling also, where in the 80s, where it just where the characters became superheroes and just, it was really just larger than life on a different scale than had existed before for both things.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the point of this music, of this hard rock from the 80s was not, you know, was not to equalize the audience and the performer. You know, I mean, that was, it was the opposite. It was really, these are exactly superheroes on the stage. And it, what, you know, they are not like, it wasn't like this unifying thing. You were there to adore and sort of, and worship them. And as a kid, I did. And then what happened, to answer the second half of your question, if you still like, if you still want an answer, you can cut me off at any time. When I got out of college, I started working at Guitar World magazine. So this is in 1994. And this gets to why we did the book. And Richard actually came in as like an intern a couple of years later. And in that era, like 94, 95, 96, even though the guitar players from these bands, Vito Bratta, George Lynch, all these guys had been on the cover of Guitar World, you know, for the preceding decade, by 94, 95, it was literally as if this stuff had not happened. You know, like the magazine did not cover these guys anymore. And so there was very little opportunity for, you know, the better part of a decade and probably into like the early 2000s to even write about this stuff or talk to these people, you know. And Rich and I, who ended up working for the same company for many years, we would just basically, that was our quote unquote water cooler talk. We would, you know, some people talk about baseball. We talked about hair metal. Like, who do you think was better, Janie Lane or this? Like, and it just went on for years and years and years, like of us working together and being friends. And and the sort of the real moment where it all came together was, I also record and produce bands. That's sort of my other gig. I work with Dave Hill. I work with Not a Surf. I work with these bands. And I actually got fired by a band that was fronted by Paul Stanley's son. And it crushed me. And for some reason that day good band, but and somehow that day I was like, I cannot leave. I need to do this book and do something for myself where I'm not at the mercy of musicians all the time. Sure. And I think I called you like that day and I was like, dude, do you want to do the book? Because we had always talked about the book. There was no other book. It was the book that we had talked about for doing for years, and he was like, yeah, and that was, you know, and then that began a 4-year odyssey, basically,
For which then, we were at the mercy of other bands.
Like, sure, back again. Yeah. Yes. And you're just like, well, by all means, I don't want to be at the mercy of metal of other musicians, metal guys, and then suddenly you're just like, I wonder if I can get an interview with Don Dokken. Now I'm at Don Dokken is shoving me around. Now. What was the process of getting the ball rolling like, to go from it's a concept and it's a huge concept, and then suddenly you now have to go story by story, step by step through it and start gathering these characters together. What were some of the adventures with the physical assembling of the oral part of the oral history?
Well, I don't know if Tom felt the same way, but I think one of the saving graces for me at the beginning was I don't know that I really thought about that part of it all that much. I mean, I think the reason we had put off doing it for so long was certainly because both of us were sort of scared of jumping into this because of our, you know, beyond our own personal issues and anxieties, we both just love this music so much that we knew we would go really deep, and that was sort of frightening. But once we had that conversation, then it was just, I mean, I think for me at least, within the next 2 or 3 days, I had an interview scheduled with Stephen Piercy anyway for a solo record he was working on at the time. And I just asked him, like, I was like, hey, I'm going to be doing this book. Can I interview you for it? And he was like, yeah, call me back later this afternoon. We'll do it. And we did it. So, you know, so it was like, couple days in, it's like, okay, well, we have Stephen Piercy, and Tom had people on his end. And it was just sort of like, we didn't go into it like, okay, let's figure out how we're going to tell the Motley Crue story and let's go after everyone in that world. Then let's figure out Cinderella, go after. It was just like anyone we could think of, you just start reaching out and put tentacles out everywhere and then just get all the stuff in and then figure out how to mold it into something, you know, after that, like a puzzle basically. But there was not, and through doing that, we both sort of naturally gravitated towards bands that we loved. You know, Tom was doing White Lion and I was doing Faster Pussycat and, you know, so on and so forth. But as far as reaching out to people, it was just like, just whoever you think of, like, go find them and then worry about how it all pieces together later on.
Yeah.
It's there's definitely, I mean, it's sort of, not to get like too into making the sausage, but, you know, there was two phases to making the book. There was the, you know, the first year is you want to do a book and you're interviewing people for a book, but you don't have a book deal. So you're really, you know, just relying on the kindness of strangers and people, you know, or people who are friends, you know, friends of friends or associates. So like I went over to JJ French of Twisted Sister's apartment, on the Upper West Side for 3 hours, 'cause I knew him from other places. And you really at that first stage, taking a little bit what you can get, because, you know, people don't necessarily want to talk to you for 2 hours for a book that may not exist. Particularly, you know, a lot of these guys have been, is there cursing on this show yeah, or not cursing?
Curse if you want. Yeah, go ahead.
Have been quote unquote shat on a lot by people in the press. So I think we had to get like build up the reputation sort of in this world that we were true fans and that we weren't just asking people the same four questions and like, do you think you looked stupid like when you dressed like that for that album cover?
This isn't like some punchline kind of like laughing at the form, but you guys actually love the music.
Right. Because that is usually what happens, I think, when journalists and quote unquote hair metal artists convene, someone ends up like the artist, you know, you can make anyone look dumb if you pick the right quote. So we had to, I think we built up trust in the community. And a lot of, you know, our interviews were through one guy telling another, like vetting us for another guy, you know, like one guy in Cinderella is like, no, they're cool. And then suddenly you're talking to everybody else in the band. So there was a little bit of, you know, of that and earning trust. 'Cause really these guys, like, you know, have been treated very, very badly, sometimes with good reason,
it's funny. It's like, and I will say just to the rest of the crew on this, you can jump in at any point with it, but I'm gonna ask this point as a question. There's such a funny thing involved in watching the rise and fall of a certain scene, a certain movement, whatever you want to call it. Because especially one that's based on making them seem like gods. And then when suddenly they look human, it brings out a bunch of emotions where it's like, it's a little sad to see gods not be gods, but then there's something kind of, it's much more relatable to see them, because you can, who can relate to a bands playing in front of 20,000 people, but you can relate to people who've paid some dues and had it, lost it, and they're getting some version of it back again that might not look the same, but they're just paying their dues, and they're actually human.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's why, I mean, there's a handful of bands, probably like 10 bands, where we follow kind of the through line of their career through the decade. And I think that we really hone in on the early part of it, because that is the part that I think both of us found most interesting. A, it's the part that you don't know as well because they weren't famous yet. But, and Tom has made this point, I'm sort of stealing it from him, but you know, these bands, once they do make it, a lot of times the story is kind of the same, you know, because they get really popular and they play arenas and they have, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll and all that and platinum records and blah, blah, blah. And then eventually the downfall, so on and so forth. But it's in the early parts of their careers, at least I found really interesting. And also, you know, to really stress the point, like we were trying to show like, hey, a lot of people think of this music as this sort of very corporate, like major label created, you know, MTV slick video type of thing. But these guys really all came from really scrappy beginnings. And, you know, they're starting their own record labels and recording their own records. And like the labels want, majors want nothing to do with them in the early days. You know, it really is a movement that's as DIY as like, you know, punk rock or indie rock or whatever you want to say.
One thing,
people don't often think of it that way. So we really wanted to stress that.
Sure. But one thing to that is very interesting about that. So I'm glad you made that point, because there's something, this scene of metal, hard rock artists, they utilized the playbook that punk bands, hardcore bands were using to get the word out, flyering like crazy, you know, grinding it out, making the shows happen at any cost. There was really like a scrappy attitude that did not come from the metal world necessarily, but comes from the punk world. And the hardcore war, when you think of like Black, these bands, Motley Crue wasn't doing anything that Black Flag hadn't been doing already in terms of papering Los Angeles with flyers everywhere they could put them to let people know the show's coming. But the difference is Black Flag's like goal for existing wasn't to be famous and be millionaires. That was not like that is the underlying goal for so many of these bands, is we want to be stars and we want people screaming our names. It wasn't just music for the sake of music. I don't want to diminish it and say that they didn't care about the music, because that's obviously not true, but they had larger goals in mind for it outside of just being in a band and getting people to see the show this weekend.
Well, I mean, that's, I think it's, you know, it's sort of like who they worshiped, right? I mean, like if you want to, if you grew up and your band was like either Kiss or Judas Priest versus The Clash, you know what I mean? Then that's where you're going to go with it. And I think that is. And the other thing I think that's really important, and I'm not saying that everyone in punk bands has money, because it's not at all true, but like there really was a, you know, and this might have been one of the last generations where this is true. Like a lot of these people are getting out of really, you know, they're going to have very, very humdrum lives doing maybe not the funnest jobs if this doesn't work for them. They're not, these are not guys who went to college and then are doing this for a couple of years and then they're going to go get, you know, an MBA or something. If they didn't make it doing this, I don't think any of them really had a plan B. So it really was
like a ticket out. They're looking for a ticket.
You know?
Go ahead.
I kind of think that Axl Rose may have gone to like Ball State. Gotten like a really good degree, some Indiana Possible. School.
I think you know, when you and you gentlemen who actually wrote the book might be able to speak to this a little bit more than I can, but just from looking at old flyers and stuff like that in the early days, it looks like there was a lot of bills on either, maybe it's either the Starwood or the Fleetwood, I get the two confused, where there was like a mixed bill of early punk bands, early hardcore bands, and the early, what we would call hair metal bands. And I think, this is my hypothesis, I think, you know, there's always this like story about like the early days of LA punk where the hardcore kids moved in and the art school kids said, well, now it's all violent, we don't like it. And I think club owners were kind of like, well, the hardcore kids are making this not fun anymore. And then there's all these people who are just putting in the same amount of gumption, putting, you know, people in the seats and making it work for the clubs and, you know, everyone's fun, good time without necessarily the same amount of violence that you had with the hardcore kids.
And on top of that is they're not drinking at the hardcore shows, which just from the club owner's point of view, that's the biggest.
That would close the Azari's, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that we didn't know doing this book, and Rich, please cut in on me if I'm talking too much. But one of the things we didn't know was that.
Hi, everybody. Tim Heidecker here to let you know about our latest episode of Office Hours Live.
Office Hours is great fun.
With the great John Early and Theda Hamill.
Very handsome.
Thank you. They're here to talk about their new movie, Stress Positions. And we just had a wonderful time. There was a lot of laughter and joy. Don't believe me? Well, listen for yourself on the podcast app of your choice. You're not going to want to miss a second. That's at Office Hours Live at the podcast app of your choice. Bum, bum, bum,
bum, bum. I love Vic and Doug, and I love drinking my wine.
How much these guys, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, but how uncool hard rock was in, say, like 1979, 1980.
Give some context for how it was perceived.
It was perceived as dinosaur music. At that time, like 1979, 1980, and going back to what Joe was saying about the clubs, like there's like one whiskey poster that I found during research, and it's like, you know, like 2 weeks in January, and it's like X, the Go-Go's, the Germs, blank, and then like Quiet Riot, and then the Plimsolls. I'm making up some of the bands, but you get the gist. These guys in the hard rock bands with their long hair were actually the outsiders at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of were afraid to go to the punk shows because they might get their ass kicked. But also, they were not the ones who were on standby to get signed. You had a much better chance getting signed in like a punky new wave band than as a hard rock band, you know. And the labels were absolutely not focused or and totally dismissive of the long-haired hard rock bands. They were like, this is some 70s holdover bullshit. We have no interest in it. We want the next Elvis Costello. We want the next Knack. So these guys were really totally marginalized as the decade starts, and really with seemingly like no hope of breaking through.
But didn't there? I mean, you had Ozzy at that point in time, who was putting out some pretty big singles. I mean, was that what they were aspiring to? Or, I mean, is it just because it's Ozzy Osbourne, people still respect that as the hard rock of the time?
Well, I think if you really look at it, like if you look at Ozzy in, you know, 81, he's doing Blizzard of Oz, like he was kind of seen as a joke too. And he was seen as washed up. You know, Blizzard of Oz now it's considered this classic record. I don't think that it did that well at the time. Like his tour wasn't that big at the time either. You know, I think that it's, and I'm sort of the same mind. Like I think back on my childhood and I'm like, well, this stuff was huge all the time. But it really, like Tom said, it took us doing this book to really hear from everybody. You know, and because it wasn't just the bands trying to sort of puff up what they had to go through. It was also the guys we talked to at the labels and the people we talked to that worked at the clubs. It's like really nobody wanted this music at all. And the label, like Tom said, I mean, it was considered dinosaur music. And there's one thing where if you're a punk band and punk is sort of outside the mainstream and yeah, like, you know, the major labels aren't really touching that stuff either, but at least you still have this sort of badassery going for you and you're kind of outside the system and you're like tough and you're living on the fringes. Like, you know, you might not be making it in the mainstream world, but on some level you're still seen as kind of cool and dangerous. Like these bands were not, they didn't even have that. They were just seen as lame by the mainstream.
At least you could get critical response if you're repping punk bands, signing punk bands. Yeah, at least there was a scene in place, mm-hmm. and it was all considered more or less new, and not just like here's some retread of something. Well, we did this already, and you know, Kiss is over. Why would we go back and do another Kiss now? Since people had Kiss, enjoyed it, and then rejected it.
Right. And Kiss in 1980, 1981 was really a terrible thing. It is not something that you want to revisit.
You don't like music from The Elder?
You know, well, I mean, and my tastes are not really sort of what anyone should go by anyway, but uh-huh. but obviously, like,
I'm kidding.
A label. No, but yeah, of course. But like a label in 1981 is not going to want to deal with a band that is bringing that kind of thing into them, because that is not selling mm-hmm. at all.
Did they have yeah. the makeup off by then? Was that the Lick It Up era?
Not yet, but they did have the short hair. So right. it was oh, okay. the makeup and the short hair was a bad moment.
The makeup, I think. The makeup went off in 83, correct? Yes. Right around there. Yeah. The other thing, we're talking a little bit about punk rock being an entry point, but I also kind of think they also kind of followed the Halen playbook to kind of push through, correct?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that was interesting is, so, you know, Van Halen got signed in like 76, 77. And all of these bands in our book, there's like, you know, in the early chapters, there's all of these guys, George Lynch from Dokken, you know, mm-hmm. they all think when Van Halen gets signed off the strip, because they're all kind of already there, Don Dokken and sort of these guys are you know, playing in bands at this time on the strip. They all think that they're going to get, when Van Halen gets signed and makes it big, they think they're all going to get like sucked up right away. You know, they think like, here we go. This is it. Van Halen got, you know, Van Halen is a hit. Here we go. And yeah. in fact, what happens is that doesn't happen. Like the labels there, the producer, Ted Templeman, who produced all the Van Halen records and actually also the Doobie Brothers. He has an autobiography, and in it, he explains going to see Van Halen for the first time at the Starwood. And he, you know, he had heard about this guy, and when he saw Van Halen play, his thought wasn't even about this band being like the template of a new, you know, kind of like California flavored hard rock. Like it was the furthest thing from his mind. In his mind, he said, you know, he saw this band, he saw this guitar player, and he's like, this guy, and I'm quoting, but not precisely, he's like, I saw this guitar player, and I realized that this guy was as good as, like, John Coltrane, and I had seen Coltrane, you know, and so, like, his thing and Mo Austin's thing was, we need this guitar player on our label. We need this guy's the next Jeff Beck. He is a, you know, serious musician. They were already thinking, like at that time, Ted Templeman is already thinking, I don't know about this David Lee Roth guy. Maybe I'll get Sammy Hagar from the band Montrose that I produced a couple of years ago. So they weren't really signing a hard rock band. They were signing this guitar player who they realized was, you know, the future of guitar. So
that happened to have a guy who sounds like Jim Dandy from Black Oak, Arkansas.
Exactly. Yeah. And Scatman Crothers. Yeah. So these bands all think that they're going to like follow through the door, but the door just closes and none of them are getting signed, which brings us, you know, it's really still just the new wave band. So like Van Halen is like an outlier, and they are the template for all of the bands that follow in terms of the guitar hero and the blonde singer and all that stuff, and you know, really the look and music about girls and fun instead of about the devil and sorcerers and shit like that. But there's not like this direct through line where, you know, it's not like where you see Guns N' Roses get signed and then there's a million bands with cowboy boots and bandanas.
But didn't Quiet Riot sort of open the gates? That was my impression. That their success sort of created the whole movement, I thought. And I'm an out, you know, I'm not a, I don't know this music really well. I was in my 20s in the 80s. And I'm from New Jersey. I heard this music in strip clubs at the time.
There you go.
It was very popular there. But
it still is, Mike.
Yeah, I guess it is. But I'm out of the strip clubs. It's been a while. But that was my only exposure to it. And Bon Jovi, who I consider sort of a pinnacle of this genre, I really disliked them from the get-go. So, you know, reading, this was sort of a whole new world of music. I had picked up years ago, there was a compilation called, what is it called? 80s Metal Gold. And, you know, it's got a lot of these bands on there. And the bands I tended to sort of like a little more, their template wasn't Van Halen. It was either Aerosmith or AC/DC. And I guess in Cinderella, you had a band that sort of had both of those. So I kind of like the Cinderella track. I like their story in the book. They seem to be the ones who never really achieved major success. They achieved success more than most bands. But they never, you know, were huge, I don't think. But they were sort of like a working class band. They kept doing it. So I sort of like their story. I was familiar with some of the Motley Crue antics and Guns N' Roses.
There's a YouTube somewhere where you can see Cinderella doing a commercial for some local hot dog stand. And that always endeared them to me forever. But to your point, I think a lot of people think a lot of the bands were imitating Axl, but I think you're right, Mike. I think they were imitating Bon Scott era AC/DC. That's what I always thought Axl was doing. And then, you know, when Guns N' Roses made it big, I think everyone was like, oh, like we're all trying to sound like that guy. But I don't think they were.
Yeah, I heard it in Kix. I think they have a little bit of the Aerosmith AC/DC thing going.
Yeah, but other groups clearly are, I guess it really does. So much of it comes down to who came first and who's your hero. And, you know, if your hero, I mean, like, look with Bon Jovi, I mean, Bon Jovi always just wanted to be some version of Bruce Springsteen. Ultimately, that's like, that's definitely really what was in his hard wiring. You know, if you strip it all away, it's like that's who that kid grew up idolizing. And so even though it's got the trappings of hard rock and metal, it's just like the further down the road he gets, the further away from the cookie cutter version of it. But other people were just metal till I die with no other real kind of. Doesn't seem like some of these acts seem to not have a whole lot of influences other than the bands you could predict.
And Bon Jovi got the last laugh because he got the rest stop named after him in Jersey over Springsteen.
Well, yeah. I think, I mean, that last point is a really good point because that's what happens at the end of the era when the scene starts to die. And it's one of the things that becomes a big talking point in our book, where it's like, okay, well, we will talk about Nirvana and Smells Like Teen Spirit and grunge. And you know, there will be people in the book that will say that killed the scene. But there's a lot of people in the book that also say, well, these bands were, A, some of them were not doing their best work at this point, and B, like the whole scene was just glutted with so many acts, and the sphere of influence had gotten so tight because you had bands that were coming out in 1989 that were influenced by Poison and Motley Crue, and these bands that had only been around a couple of years and were actually at the height of their popularity. So
these are bands like Bang Tango.
Yeah,
are we talking about?
Well, and one, I mean, a prime example would be a band like Tough, who Stevie Rochelle, the singer, you know, is very open about the fact that, like, hey, he looked exactly like Bret Michaels. And that got him pretty far. You know, it certainly got him far. It got him in the band. It got him a level of success on the strip, for sure. And then, you know, they got a major label deal. But he's totally open about the fact that he looked like Bret. He dressed like Bret. I mean, the band kind of sounds like Poison. Mm-hmm. You know, Poison's only three albums in at this point. Like, you don't need a band that looks and sounds and dresses exactly like them. And Tough isn't the only one. I mean, if you went to the strip in 1989, there's probably 15 or 50 of them. So that influence gets so tight that it's just like, there's nowhere to go. really.
And the scene was 10 years in at that point. That's a mm-hmm. long time for a musical scene. That's just 10 years is for to be as popular as this metal hair metal was. A decade? That's an eternity in popular music.
That's longer than grunge.
Yeah. I mean, it's twice as long as grunge.
I have to say, I really appreciated how you kind of handled the ending, because so many books and documentaries just kind of say, and then Nirvana happened at the end. And I really did appreciate that. I was like, well, there was this and that and that. And, you know, as someone, someone who grew up in Los Angeles, like I didn't really see the difference between, you know, what we called alternative back then and a punk band, you know, or a metal band. It would be like, oh, I love, you know, Jane's Addiction, and I love, Aerosmith, Poison. But those bands like a Jane's Addiction or like a Faith No More or stuff like that, they weren't the big, big, big kick. But a lot of them were just kind of doing something a little different. I was like, oh, this is weird, and we're going to call that alternative. And it wasn't, you know, there were these baby steps that were happening, you know, in the early 90s that I think, you know, finally, you know, broke the door. I mean, Lollapalooza happened in 1991. Nirvana wasn't like huge yet, right?
Well, the record wasn't even out yet.
It wasn't out yet. That record wasn't out.
My question about the Nirvana point is, you know, when you were talking to these musicians and they brought up Nirvana, and some of them were still a little bitter about it, and then some of them felt like they had come to terms with it, and they're like, oh, you know, I like Nirvana now, and I was always part of that whole, you know, I enjoyed the grunge thing. Could you tell which musicians were like, you know, especially the ones that were like, oh no, I'm cool with it, that they probably changed their tune over time?
Yeah, like what was it like? Please talk as much as you want about what it was like to bring up the Nirvana question to these.
Going back to what you were saying way at the beginning of this, like, I think we, and I will get to answering your question, but like, we did get to these people at a good time. And Rich was talking about this too. I mean, you know, if we had tried to do this book in 1997, everyone involved would have been miserable and like bussing tables, or, you know, in like just in a horrible mood because they were completely canceled at that point. Now the people in these bands are out working again, like you said. You know, they're playing, they all, you know, some of them have day jobs too, but they go out and they do weekend dates. They fly in, there's equipment there, they fly out. A lot of them are taking home more money than when they had, you know, all of this overhead. And sort of this music has been accepted, you know, it's somewhat as like, it's been let into the classic rock sort of pen now. So like these guys and women are not as shell-shocked as they were. So you can bring it up with them. And I think that, what a lot of them feel like is that it's not Nirvana that bothered them. I mean, it's that they were, and this is what is odd about this music, and part of what fascinated both Rich and I about it, and it always has, is it's not like that the music fell out of fashion. You know, it's not like pop punk in the aughts or whatever, where, you know, you've got some big bands and then it sort of fades away. You know, the guys in Blink 182 don't have to pretend that they were never in Blink 182. The people in these bands in like the early to mid 90s could not say that they had been in these bands. There's this story in the book where Brian Forsyth from Kix, who is like a great guitar player and a great guy to interview, in the book, he gets hooked up to go audition for the Wallflowers in like 1994. He's living in LA. And mind you, like Kix were not the biggest band of the era, but they had a platinum album and like a number 9 single, you know, so they were pretty big. And he goes to this audition and does not even mention that he was in Kix because he knows that that would be immediate disqualification. Like, everyone who produced these records, who was in the bands, who the A&R guys who signed the bands, they all were just thrown out completely and unemployable for like the better part of a decade. So it was a real, you know, it's not like the old guard sort of like being a little bit envious of the new guard. It's that they were just, there was like a coup, and these, they were just totally shocked because like you're saying, in the beginning, in like this 91 zone, there was actually like a peaceful 90-91, like a weird initial peaceful coexistence. Like there, you know, I saw Alice in Chains open for Extreme at the Cat Club in New York City. You know, Skid Row toured with Pantera. There were these concrete foundation things in LA where like Skid Row is playing with Soundgarden. You know, and a lot of the guy like Kim Thayil and Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, they didn't hate hard rock. So there was an initial coexistence. And I think when Nirvana came out, you know, for the first 3 or 4 months, people, like, I think a lot of the people in these bands were like, oh, that's a fucking kick-ass song, and this band rocks, you know? And, you know, Guns N' Roses asked them to go on tour with them. Skid Row asked Nirvana to go on tour with them. So there wasn't this sense immediately that it was going to be like this binary question where one thing would live and one thing would be completely extinct immediately. So I think a lot of them were just really surprised because this doesn't usually happen like that. They were just, you know, shocked. Yeah.
It's interesting because they, when certain people talk, like one of the Twisted Sister guys talks about where it's just like, yeah, it was like you go to Thanksgiving dinner and then Thanksgiving dinner gets taken away. And it's just like, but I mean, look, the timeline for Twisted Sister doesn't even remotely track to be impacted by grunge. I mean, there's like good 5-year gap before. So that's not being honest with how it actually went down. But so much of the complaining about them ties back to they looked like regular people on stage. Like that's a smear as far as the metal bands were concerned, that Nirvana could be dressed like they were in the audience. And that's how they go up on stage and they just play the guitar. They play the songs and they just do it without the frills. And the thing is that the scene, like you had said earlier, had started to maybe rot a little bit, chasing its own tail, and there's an ugliness that can settle into certain scenes when it's just nothing but success and reward. You don't have to be as mindful of other things, and I think they might, you know, certain people don't seem to take that into account, that people maybe just had gotten their fill with it and that it was not maybe the most fun scene anymore either. Like the metal stuff was just a little played out and maybe not so much fun.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, there's a lot to be said to that point, that in whether or not grunge comes in or alternative or any of that, there's just nowhere left to go, because what are you going to do in 1990, you look at Poison, for instance, right? They put out the Flesh and Blood record. You know, on the back of that, they're in jeans and cowboy boots and their hair is not hair sprayed up, it's down. I mean, they certainly still look like, I mean, they don't look like a grunge band, but they also don't look like the Poison of Look What the Cat Dragged In. And there's no Nirvana, you know, at least on the mainstream stage yet. None of that has really hit yet. So these bands...
But there is a Guns N' Roses by that point.
Well, yeah, so. And that's a point that I think we make in the book too, and that Tom and I have certainly talked about a lot in interviews, is that Guns N' Roses might have had more of an effect on this scene and more of a shift on this scene than maybe even Nirvana and grunge did, because people, I mean, all these bands start to change when Guns N' Roses hits, you know. But so for a band in 1990, they can't look and sound the way they did in 1986. The fans don't want that anymore, but then the fans don't necessarily want them changing either. So you're kind of stuck, you know, you're kind of in a catch 22 there. Like, you can't, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, damned if you don't. And at the same time, also, like, kids, people are getting older. So mm-hmm. for a new generation to come in, like Quiet Riot, Twisted Sister, all this stuff from like 84, 85, like, that's their older brother's shit. They don't want that anymore.
I thought that point you guys made towards the end about Garth Brooks was really interesting. I never, with the sound reporting, the digital, you know, barcode stuff, I didn't ever consider that. I always heard the Nirvana argument, and I've never heard anything about that. But that was really interesting. I had no idea.
Could you explain what that is? The sound scan, when that rolled in, that's what you're talking about, Pat?
Yes.
This is a, Rich, do you want to take this, or you want me to?
I think it was someone you interviewed that said that.
Okay. I think it was. And it was basically, it's a theory that, you know, before SoundScan basically came in and was a method for record stores. They would scan the barcode code, and so, and the charts became based on the actual sales of records, which, I mean, it sounds weird that it wasn't before that. But before SoundScan comes in, where the charts are directly tied to units sold, it's a weird and very, very corruptible algorithm combining like radio play and sales and this and that and the other thing, much more fuzzy math. And so the theory that this manager presents is that, like, it's possible that for the last couple years of this hard rock thing, the books were totally cooked, and really these bands selling what they were. And I mean, look, I don't know if that's true or not, but they also weren't drawing as well.
Or putting out the best records.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the thing I will say about Nirvana, and this is me saying it and not someone in one of the bands, but I do think that I think a lot of the alternative bands maybe weren't punk rock kids. They were also rock kids, you know, particularly the hard rock ones, like the Pearl Jam guys and the Soundgarden guys had all grown up on Sabbath and Priest and so, and the Alice in Chains guys, you know. Kurt Cobain was a really like a fully like punk rock indie guy, and so he had that baggage about you know, he really had the baggage about authenticity and about, you know, staying true to yourself, but also, and, you know, which seems much more normal today, he was completely disgusted by what he perceived as the homophobia and misogyny of the hard rock bands of the 80s. And he had zero tolerance for that stuff. Like, that's why they didn't go on tour with Guns N' Roses, because they're these homophobic lyrics. Mm-hmm. Guns N' Roses song, it was like zero tolerance. And so I think that his, and I don't even think that attitude was possibly that of the other people in Nirvana, even, but he was the sort of spiritual figurehead of this sort of new movement. And I think that and I feel like people, you know, just fell in with that. And I think that that's where sort of the wholesale rejection on some level of what came before it was sort of some shockwave of his aesthetic.
Where it's as cultural as it is musical, if not more. It's more of a just like, I don't like the philosophy of this. I'm sure there was still music that look, he grew up with hard rock and loving hard rock and all this stuff. And yeah, so he has an affinity for the same stuff that a lot of those other guys came up listening to, but he also just didn't like the trappings of it. The, you know, just the inherent sexism and just implied, you know, homophobia and all that stuff just did not track, because also it really was, it's easy. Two things that are easy to lose sight of when, if you weren't like alive during that, and I was, it's just like, it was getting like the kind of thing, like the Sebastian Bach stuff, when he wore the shirt that said about AIDS, the rage shirt that was AIDS, just like, he truly thought it was just like, I don't know. It just seemed like they thought they were like royalty, like they were untouchable at that point. Like these artists really thought they were, they believed that because they were playing in front of 20,000 people, that they were just gods.
Yeah. And
that there was no consequence or anything. Like Sebastian Bach seemed truly stunned that people had any criticism of him in any form ever, is what it felt like at that point in time.
Well, Sebastian, and he makes this point in the book as well, he's like, you know, he was marketed as hard rock's bad boy and celebrated, and he's like, so what did you expect? I mean, well, first of all, he's also Sebastian Bach, and he's a fucking lunatic, which is one of the great things 19. About him.
And he's that's, 19 yeah. at that point.
That's the thing, too. Yeah, I mean,
he's a savage animal.
Yeah, well, there you go.
thank you.
You have to say it, savage animal.
Somebody had to say it.
But, you know, since the time he was 19, he has gotten everything that he has wanted.
He's this physically beautiful figure on stage who is has this booming voice and is super tall, just like a command. Like he just seems like he has everything.
Yeah. And so, and I mean, he says in the book too, it's like somebody gave him the shirt. He just threw it on, but he probably didn't think that much about it. Now he could be, you know, sort of telling the story in a way that protects him a little bit, but it also could very well be true. I mean, whether or not he read the shirt first, and he probably did. And, you know, one of us might've been like, oh, I'm not going to put that on. Like he also probably didn't give it more than a second's thought, you know, and then he just threw it on. So, and those are the consequences, because then you're photographed wearing it. But yeah, to your earlier point, I mean, I don't think a lot of these guys really did think about the consequences. I think that they thought they were above it, because also their bad behavior was always rewarded. I mean, these bands also all idolized Motley Crue, and Motley Crue, I mean, were like just bad actors all around, but that's what made them Motley Crue.
Singer killed someone.
Yeah. And, you know, it didn't hurt them at all. You could make the argument that helped them. I mean, and then their bassist died.
Yeah. And, the Guns N' Roses album came out, you know, that one in a million is like one of the lyrics to this day are not any less tame. It's still shocking when you hear it today. And they put it out, and the excuse was just kind of like, I'm not going to get into it. If you don't get it, you don't get it. And I'm just like, who could get away with that ever?
Axl Rose.
Yeah.
True.
Now, who, we'll get to some questions that people had sent in.
I've got some listener questions here.
But working on this, who were some of the surprises when you did interviews? Who were people that you were surprised you got? Because did you get Izzy Stradlin to participate?
No.
Because there is a quote, there are a couple quotes from him. I wasn't sure how they were sourced, though.
Yeah, they were sourced. I mean, I think a few of them are from an old Guitar World. I mean, you know, then there was one other article. I would say Izzy, there were a few people we didn't get. Izzy, I think, was the one guy we didn't get where we didn't even bother to try.
Like, you kind of know where that's going.
There's no point.
So who were some of the surprises in terms of, like, who'd you come away going like, oh my God, that guy's so much different than I ever would have thought when I was a kid listening to their music? And the thing is, I keep saying guy over and over.
Right.
It's a pretty safe bet to say guy when you're talking about this whole
weird, the thing is, like, for me, and honestly, like, it wasn't a surprise, because I've worked with a lot of female musicians, et cetera, but like, the how cool everyone in Vixen was like a real surprise to me. And also, and the bass player Cher, like, especially like, she, you know, replaced Paul Simonon in Havana 3 a.m. like, after he left, like, and you're like, really, what? Were to me, like, just great to talk to, because there's you know, they talk about bad things that happened to them, but really they were just like tough and like ass kicking. So that was a surprise, like, how much fun talking to them was. For me, the big one was Vito Bratta from White Lion, the guitar player, because he had only done one interview in the preceding 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I love him. Like, he is, to me, the best guitar player of all of these guys in a weird way. And he is a person who, when this stuff ended, like, he literally just never played again. He just lives on Staten Island with his mom and a parrot. And like, so getting to talk to him and having him be delightful and sort of feeling like I was connecting with him was like this huge, like, special treat. Like, it's really possible this whole book for me was like a pretext to have a reason to interview him. And so when it actually came through, I was like, oh shit. He was, you know, he was amazing. And, you know, Ricky Rocket from Poison was also like incredibly sort of like honest and frank and like would answer your questions, which is something that some people won't do. Like, some people, you ask them a question and they answer what they want to answer, but it could not be the question. And he really would address everything you threw at him, which I thought was great.
And who might be on the other side of things where you're just like, yikes?
You know, I mean, it sounds like a cop out, but I don't know that there really was anyone on my end. Like, I'm sort of trying to rack my brain a little bit.
That sounds like a cop out.
You know, I guess the one person I'll say, and it's actually why he's not even in the book, but it's just a boring story, was I interviewed Jizzy Pearl from Love Hate for the book. You know, and he just wasn't that cooperative. You know, he had some newer stuff going on at the moment too. He seemed kind of annoyed about, you know, this sort of line of questioning that was just about the past. He kind of wasn't really giving anything up. It was just kind of just one or two word answers.
Oh, wow.
And just sort of being very obvious about the fact that he didn't want to talk about this shit and go back and look at that again. So sure. What wound up happening is that he just doesn't have a voice in the book, which I'm sure he doesn't give a shit one way or the other, but I would have loved to have him in there, because I know that he has a pretty unique take on things and that he's actually a pretty smart guy. I mean, he's written some books and, you know, where he kind of looks back on his experience on the strip that actually is pretty funny. But he just didn't want to do it for us. And that's his choice. So, I mean, that was really the only one for me that I was like, well, that was kind of a waste of a half hour. But otherwise, you know, to sort of jump on what Tom was saying, like, there was no one that really, on the other side, that really surprised me either, because everybody was just really great, actually. Like, they were all really surprisingly open about their history and more or less clear-eyed, given what a lot of these people have been through and what they, you know, what they did to their bodies and their brains back then. You wouldn't necessarily expect that, but like, everyone's stories usually tracked with everyone else's stories. You know, and like a guy, like, I'll point to a guy like Tracy Guns for me, because he was a friend also previous to us doing this book, but beyond being someone we could just go to whenever we had a question, you know, he vouched for us and, you know, he texted Tamie Down, he texted Ricky Rackman and all these guys. And he was like, hey, talk to these guys, you know, like, they're doing a good thing here. And there were a few people like that, that really, you know, their help was just not just in their own stories, but in getting other people on board was just enormous.
I think that shines through too. I think I really enjoyed reading what Tracy had to say in the book. Mm-hmm. Really came through for me.
Mike, who would you say your favorite, is there anybody who you think was like a good guy coming out of this? You not as a fan of the music necessarily, but just like, oh, that guy seems all right. And who else would you say like, man, that's what I thought the worst of this scene would be?
Well, I would say Cinderella was sort of the band that I was sort of rooting for. They seemed sort of level-headed. They didn't seem excessive, you know. They just sort of did their thing. They achieved some success. They didn't become, you know, ridiculous. Like, I guess you could say Motley Crue just is sort of the epitome of a rock excess. Mm-hmm. So that was the band that sort of appealed to me. Sure. I'm listening to some of the you guys didn't, you know, I was listening. I was doing some homework before the show. So I was listening to 80s Metal Gold, and they've got Kingdom Come on there.
Which is what we should have called the book.
They've got Kingdom Come on there, which I don't think you guys even touched that band, did you?
We did not.
Was that a choice, or just you weren't interested in that band? I know they have a German singer. They're sort of like a Led Zeppelin knockoff band. Mm-hmm. You know?
We basically, in order to preserve our sanity, stayed with American bands. I mean, there's like one or two quotes from, I mean, Ozzy's obviously not American, and there's a couple quotes from Def Leppard guys, but we knew that if we went into like bands from Germany or like DAD from Sweden, and we started like just doing all that, like we had to like circumscribe it. We had to like draw the line somewhere, or we'd still be working on it. So it wasn't like that they were, that we thought they sucked or anything like that. It was just that we were always relieved to find a reason not to have a band in, because with the oral history format where it's all of these quotes, to tell the story of a band or of an event, you need like four or five people to have different perspectives on an event. So any band that you decide to cover like that, you've got to talk to everybody and the manager and the, you know, this and the that, and that can be a month of your life. Mm-hmm. So you got to be really, go ahead.
I'll say this. One guy I came across as a real tough guy, I don't know if, is George Lynch.
Yes.
You know, which I didn't really know anything about him going into the book.
Grumpy.
But he just comes across as a real tough guy. You know, he's bragging about the tapping technique, the guitar. You know, that if he felt like he got ripped off by Eddie Van Halen. Was he a tough guy to interview, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, I did the George interview. I would say he's not the easiest. To his credit, though, he came on very early. He came on before we even had a book deal and agreed to do it. Which is saying, you know, which is a feather in his cap, because there was no reason for him to really sit and be sort of poked and prodded with all this stuff about his history. You know, but, and he is a little bit, he can be a little bit difficult. And I think also the thing that's difficult with him is there's actually a lot of like messiness in the Dokken story and in really the George Lynch story, because he comes up at the same time as, you know, Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen. And, you know, he's enjoyed a really long and successful career, but he's obviously not held in the same regard as Randy Rhoads or Eddie Van Halen. Mm-hmm. But he was at that time. So, you know, you never know how someone's going to feel about that. And the whole Dokken thing is really messy. The stories in the
book. Don Dokken seems like a handful.
Don Dokken isn't easy either. And in the book, there's a lot of, we had to get into some really crazy stories that went on. And so you have to really just go to these places that sometimes the people are wondering, like, why the hell are you even asking me this stuff? And plus it's 40 years ago. Like, I don't fucking know why I acted that way. Mm. All of which is to say, like, Don, I mean, George was great in the book. It's an interview that I'm glad is done and over with, and that I don't have to do it tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, let's get to some questions from listeners. Jason, can you read them out?
Yeah, I got a couple here for you.
Do a few.
Yeah. So this one is kind of along the lines of what we were talking about in the Nirvana area in 91. What's the best hair metal album or hard rock album that was being recorded while grunge was killing its future? Are there any standout albums in that later period?
Warrant's Dog Eat Dog is really good. And we haven't really gone there in this conversation, but in my estimation, like, Warrant and Janie Lane of Warrant was like the one of the top like craft song, like song craftsmen of that era. That record is a record that is really good, and that just came out and died a death. Rich, what do you think?
I mean, geez, like an early 90s hair metal record. I mean, I actually really love the Skid Row Subhuman Race record. And I loved it at the time. Like, I thought they were a band that was still doing great stuff in the 90s, you know, and they were a band that, I mean, they obviously took a hit because of all that stuff. But, you know, Slave to the Grind, I mean, that's the number one record in the 90s. They do that tour and Pantera's opening, and like, they can sort of hang with Pantera. They probably, you know, they probably still would have imploded anyway, but obviously their interband shit hastened all of that. But the records they were making, I thought were still really good records.
All right. What would you say is the Citizen Kane of hair metal?
Oh, I would say the Citizen Kane of hair metal is Motley Crue, Dr. Feelgood.
Okay.
Because it is the most ambitious and sort of well executed record by it wasn't like this massive thing by a first time director, but it was mm-hmm. like, it's the biggest, it's like this record that like, where they just went big and they nailed it.
And that was Bob Rock, wasn't it?
That was Bob Rock. Yeah. I mean, Metallica does the Black Album with Bob Rock because they want to sound like Dr. Feelgood.
Right.
You know, like Dr. Feelgood is, you know, and also, it's got a cameo by Robin Zander of Cheap Trick, and Cheap Trick is my favorite band of all time. But it is just like, that is the most like massive sort of platonic ideal of like what like a hair metal record should be. Like, it's just the hugeness, on some level, like the dumbness, the heaviness. You know, like you yeah. know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah.
There's a song on it called She Goes Down. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, so it's got all, it ticks all the buttons, but it's just so well done. And it's like, and it's so unusual for a band, especially a band where the guys were like a total mess, that like on their fifth record or their fourth record, they like totally knock it out of the park like that.
Rich, is it Dr. Feelgood for you?
I mean, that's I can't say that I've ever thought about this particular question before.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
But Tom kind of nailed it. I mean, I don't know that I could think of a record necessarily that hits every one of these points. But, you know, also if you're looking for like a debut sort of record, I mean, I'd always point to like the first Poison record, mm-hmm. you know, because it's like just in the sense that, I mean, it doesn't have this sort of hugeness that Tom is talking about, and that is probably a requirement for this answer, but it's just, it really, I think, encapsulates a lot of what this thing is that we're talking about and what it was, you know, and like, if you want to know what it looked like and sounded like and felt like at that time, that might be a good place to go to. And it's in terms of like, you know, being as, you know, over the top and all that as possible. I mean, they certainly hit it out of the park in terms of the look on that record, if maybe not in terms of like sound and production or songwriting or anything else.
I think it's the, I think that Look What the Cat Dragged In is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of Nirvana.
Okay. The final listener question we have for you. And we can start wrapping things up for Best Show Book Club. If you had to choose a contributor from the book to sit down with and flesh out a full bio, a full book, who would it be and why?
I mean, without concerns about whether or not anybody would purchase said book.
No concerns. No concerns. Your version, what you would like to see exist.
The Tamey Down story. I know I would read it. Might have to take a shower after writing it.
Right, right.
I would read it.
Tamey Down really is like the amount of, and if for people listening who don't know who that is, Tamey Down is the lead singer of the band Faster Pussycat. And he's like the dirtiest. He's just the role that he plays in this book in terms of like giving us like our sleaze quotient and our humor quotient. Cause like neither of us, like as interviewers, are the best at like being like, so tell me about the worst thing you ever did with a female fan. You know, he's like this little like sprinkle of pepper every 25 pages in our book. I think he's just awesome in our book. He really like, he's like without him in there, there might've been trouble. And let me see who I think I would want to, I mean, honestly, and we didn't, does it have to be someone who's, we actually already interviewed for the book? Because really who I would like to talk to and do a full life story with would be Cece DeVille of Poison.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Because he's hilarious and like self-deprecating, and he's had such a weird life. And I can say this, like, Rich and I have talked about this. Both of us being Jews, I was absolutely completely surprised when I found out that Cece DeVille was like the Scandinavian and that he wasn't like a Jew, because he's got this like slapstick. Am I digging myself into hell here? He's got like this, like his self-deprecating humor and his like his whole quote unquote shtick. I was always just like, oh, this guy is like, he's doing shtick, and he's not, and that makes him even weirder. But the fact that he was this transplant to L.A. and then he ended up, you know, hooked on crack and then blew up to 300 pounds, and everyone always called him the worst guitar player. He's like fascinating to me, and also the one who got me into this mess, because the first time I saw the Talk Dirty to Me video with that truck with guitars lined all the way down it, like that's when I was done.
Yeah,
like that was literally that I can pinpoint, like I'm like, that is my dream.
Well, especially if you're a Rick Nielsen fan.
Yeah, and I think like I didn't even know at that time, because I was only like 14, I hadn't fully keyed into Cheap Trick yet, but he obviously had, and I think he was my gateway to Rick Nielsen, oddly. You know what I mean? Like, wait, this guy is doing that thing, and then discovering Rick Nielsen and be like, oh, now I get it. Yeah.
Well, there was a power pop element to a lot of Poison songs. So I could see Poison, how that's even.
Sure, yeah.
There's a story that I've not been able to ever get a straight, I even asked Tom Werman, and he was a little bit that Rick Nielsen and not that they play on the record, but that Bunny Carlos and Rick Nielsen were brought in for the second Poison record to like give them some power pop like pointers to help them get through a couple songs.
Oh,
there's amazing. A lot of shared DNA there.
Yeah.
Because like Poison is not a metal band, they are a power pop band.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, just truth.
Well, this book, Nothing But a Good Time, is Nothing But a Good Time. I got to say, you gave it the perfect title. It's such a fun book, and I think it's it, if you aren't even a fan of metal stuff, look, I'm not. This is not where I live musically, but I know all the bands and stuff, and these stories are fascinating and they're well told, and it's interesting to just go through a decade plus with all of these acts and hear their stories. And you both did an amazing job telling the story and encapsulating an entire world. And it's just a blast to read. And anybody, if you're a fan of the music, or you're a fan of Insanity, I think you'd I just dropped it here. It's, and you'll get a lot for your value too. You hear how heavy that was?
That's a thick book.
It's a thick book. Yeah, it's a really great book, and I think people will get a real kick out of it, whether they're a fan of the music or just a fan of crazy rock stories. So thanks both of you for coming on the show. It's a real treat, and we appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. I was truly dumbfounded and honored to be picked as the first book of the best show book club.
Oh, look at the honor is ours, all ours.
Hey, before we wrap, I just wanted to acknowledge the insanity of that Jack Russell breaking and entering story. I mean, that is the you're talking about crazy rock stars. That is the craziest thing I ever heard in my life. I cannot believe he is A, still alive, and B, not behind bars. I mean, that is. I mean, it's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life.
No, it's repulsive, and and I don't know which one of you interviewed Jack Russell for this.
Well, we are. I'm adding Jack Russell to the Zoom right now. He'll be in here in a second.
Well, okay, well, I'm going to say goodbye then. I think that's my. No, it really is one of those ones where it's a story. This insanely violent story. It's like the final third of Boogie Nights is what it's like, but
with opening on that.
Nights started with that scene.
And that was just a moment. It's like you kind of just let him go and let him monologue a little bit, and you present the story, you know, uninterrupted. And I will say that he told this story, and he was not, it certainly was not something he was proud of. He wasn't like, yeah, man, you know, and then I got away with it.
And I could,
you know, he was really regretful.
I went back to that at least three times because I couldn't believe it. I had to explain it to other people, and then I had to go back to make sure I was getting it right because I had to look up who this guy was. I mean, there was so much to that. I mean, there's a lot of moments in that book too that I didn't know anything about. I mean, even like Twisted Sister being a headlining act years before signing to a label and kind of owning the East Coast's end of it. Like, I had no idea about any of that. It's really, there's a lot of nuggets like that in this book that are insightful. Oh,
there's so much to get out of it. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
The Jack Russell thing is the single longest thing where we let somebody run in the book, like in terms of the longest quote. We're like, here you go, man.
Yeah.
Wow. The floor is yours.
That's one of many thrilling and surprising stories in this book. Nothing but a good time. Tom Bojour, Richard Beanstock, thank you so much for both coming on and talking. And we will talk to you both soon.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
And Joe,
what's next?
Joe, thank you for being a best show listener and joining us.
Yes, thank you, Joe, for your wisdom, Joe Dana. And what's next? Are you guys are working on another book, or what's in the pipeline?
We are working on another book. We're going to basically do a book where we are focusing on the 90s alternative rock explosion.
Okay,
amazing.
That's exciting.
I'm in.
And the Lollapalooza festival, and just sort of taking it on in the same manner that we have with this book.
Very exciting.
Is it okay to say that, Tom?
It's okay to say that. And then theoretically there is a docuseries hopefully that is going to get made of Nothing But a Good Time.
Oh my god,
amazing. That's fantastic.
So amazing.
Fingers crossed on that one too.
Yes. thank you so much for taking the time, and we will talk to you down the road.
All right. See you later. Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks guys. Bye.